Okay, Ms. McIntyre?
Thank you, Judge. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Victoria McIntyre on behalf of Sealed Juvenile, the appellant in this matter. Juvenile was adjudicated in federal court under 18 U.S.C. 922-0 for the mere possession of box switches. The government was aware that he had also possessed a handgun that was equipped with a Glock switch, a violation of Mississippi law. And it used that conduct to prove both the elements of his offense as well as to enhance his punishment at the adjudication proceeding. Mississippi could have prosecuted this conduct. The government's prosecution of juvenile in federal court frustrated the purposes of the Juvenile Delinquency Act, which creates a presumption against juveniles' federal prosecution. Additionally, Section 922-0 is unconstitutional as applied to his mere possession of only Glock switches that were not equipped to a firearm. And I'd like to begin with the Second Amendment argument. A switch under this court's precedent, under Supreme Court precedent, must qualify as an arm for purposes of the Second Amendment because it facilitates armed self-defense. Under Bruin Step 1, Section 922-0 implicates an individual's ability to keep and bear these switches because it criminalizes their mere possession. Accordingly, we thus proceed to Bruin Step 2, and the application of 922-0 to juvenile is presumptively unconstitutional. The government failed to prove a historical tradition that would justify the regulation as applied to juveniles' mere possession. And this issue is not foreclosed yet in this circuit to the mere possession of auto sears. We recognize that the court's opinion in Wilson recently did say that Hollis versus Lynch is still good law, but in both Hollis and in Wilson, we had instances where the defendant was possessing a gun that was equipped with an auto sear in the context of Wilson or an M16 in the context of Hollis. And so there's not yet been a case that forecloses the argument as applied to the mere possession of a part, in this case being the switch. The government argued in their brief that the switches were not even within the ambit of the Second Amendment, and so they did not provide any historical justification that would support their regulation. What they did is they said that the switches did not qualify as an arm because they were a machine gun. And then applying Hollis v. Lynch said that we don't get to any kind of historical regulation analysis in step two because Hollis would be binding on the question. And I believe that that's the wrong approach here and that the district court's approach was also wrong. Bruin step one says, does the Second Amendment plain text cover the conduct at issue? And so in step one, we must first consider whether a switch constitutes an arm for purposes of the Second Amendment. And then if so, whether 922-0 implicates the individual's ability to keep and bear them. I don't think there's a question here that the switches must qualify as arms. The Second Amendment extends to all instruments that constitute arms, even those that were not in existence at the founding. Bruin and Heller both tell us that. And it covers, quote, modern instruments that facilitate armed self-defense. That's the language from Bruin. The proper test when we consider whether a component or a part in this case receives Second Amendment protection and constitutes an arm is whether it facilitates armed self-defense. We don't necessarily look at whether the part is necessary to the function of the weapon. And this court's recent opinion in Como related to suppressors and silencers, I think, tells us that that's the analysis that we must apply here. Bruin also says that it doesn't need to be necessary to a firearm's functioning, or it doesn't have to be traditionally tied to militia service either. All that we need is that the item or the part in this case is used in self-defense to, quote, cast at or strike another and to enable the act of self-defense. The switch does that. The switch allows for the more effective firing at a rate that is not, or at a rate that is enhanced by the trigger mechanism being manipulated by the part. The switches make self-defense more effective by allowing the gun to fire continuously as long as the trigger is held down. And so under that standard, they have to qualify as arms. They are weapons of offense, armor of defense, or anything that a man wears in his defense, takes in his hand, or uses in wrath to cast at or strike another. That's the qualification in Heller. And so here we have switches that fit into this definition because they make the firearm more effective, and they're also used in self-defense to cast at or strike another. Thus, they are presumptively protected by the Constitution. And we then move on to step two. Step two being the question of, is there historical tradition that supports this regulation? And in this case, this is where any kind of argument that concerned the tradition of banning, quote, dangerous and unusual weapons would lie. And so we acknowledge that that tradition has been acknowledged and upheld most recently by Wilson and prior to that in Hollis. But this historical tradition must be applied to prove that the part at issue here, the switch, is both dangerous and unusual. There's no separate precedent that allows for a finding that the part is simply dangerous. There's no tradition that banning dangerous weapons falls within our history. And there's also no tradition that just the unusual nature of the part could also justify the ban. And so here the government had the burden to prove that the switches were both dangerous and unusual, and it did neither. There's no evidence that's been submitted that the switches themselves are dangerous. And in fact, I think we have evidence to the contrary, and the government has admitted that the mere part, which is what they claim to be adjudicating juvenile for in the federal proceedings, was not dangerous. The district court also made those findings that on its own, it was just a piece of plastic. And so without a finding that they are dangerous, we can't get to a finding that they are both dangerous and unusual. I think even if there was some kind of argument that they are on their own dangerous, the government still has not met the burden of showing they're unusual. Step two requires the government to meet the burden of proving the historical tradition. And they've put forth no evidence in this case to show that the switches themselves are either dangerous or unusual. To move to the jurisdictional question, unless there are any questions as to the Second Amendment argument, we would submit, as alluded to in the beginning of the argument, that the Juvenile Jurisdiction Act, or Juvenile Delinquency Act, excuse me, establishes a presumption against the prosecution of juveniles in federal court. And that's because federal courts don't have the resources to take care of juveniles. They don't have the facilities. Federal courts are ill-equipped to deal with and rehabilitate juveniles. And so there is this presumption that exists that the states will adjudicate that conduct. Because of that, the JDA, the Juvenile Delinquency Act, establishes a certification requirement that is also a jurisdictional requirement. And there are, within that act, three different circumstances in which the government can allege that certification, make that certification, and then submit that jurisdiction is appropriate in federal court as opposed to state court. And so the submission that the government made in this case was that Mississippi did not have jurisdiction over the conduct at issue, the mere possession of the Glock switches, because at the time, the state of Mississippi did not have a law that banned the possession of machine guns. However, they did have a law that banned the possession of handguns by a juvenile, and they also had a law that banned the concealment of a machine gun. And so at the time that we went to the, or at the time that the government proved their case against the juvenile, one of the elements that they needed to prove was in terms of the juvenile knowing that these switches would be used in a certain way, or at least that was what they used the facts to do. And so as part of that process, they submitted that they knew that juvenile had used a handgun that was equipped with the switches, and he would therefore know that the switches would be used in that manner. They used that in evidence to prove their case, to prove the factual basis at the plea. And then they also used that conduct to enhance his punishment at sentencing by a little bit different situation, obviously, in a juvenile proceeding, but akin to what you would do to receive a guidelines enhancement in any other sentencing to show that the possession of those firearms justified a longer sentence than the one he may have received otherwise. And so it's our position here that the government knew that there was conduct that Mississippi could have exercised their jurisdiction over, namely the possession of a handgun by a juvenile. They used that conduct in the federal prosecution. And to allege that juvenile had only been possessing switches in order to fall within the ambit of 922-0 frustrated the purposes of the Juvenile Delinquency Act, which creates a presumption for juveniles to be prosecuted in state courts where that conduct can lie. And so the handgun equipped with the switch could have been prosecuted in state courts, and the state of Mississippi was already exercising jurisdiction over juvenile at the time, albeit we recognize in a different proceeding. But they were aware of the conduct, and it could have fallen within their ambit. So in sum here, we submit that the prosecution of juvenile in federal court was wrong, and it was against the purposes of the Juvenile Delinquency Act. The federal court should not have had jurisdiction over the matter. And if it was proper, the prosecution of juvenile under 922 Section O for the mere possession of just the Glock switches, the part, was unconstitutional as applied to him. And so for either reason, we would ask that this court reverse.
Okay, thank you, Ms. McIntyre.
Thank you.
You've saved time for rebuttal. Mr. Buckner?
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Buckner, and I represent the United States in this case. In February of 2024, the juvenile in this case began selling machine gun conversion devices, or Glock switches, to an ATF confidential informant. He sold them twice. On February 7th, he sold four of them to a confidential informant, and on February 20th, he sold eight to a confidential informant. At that time, nobody can dispute, and nobody does dispute, that Mississippi law did not prohibit the possession, sale, or use of machine gun conversion devices. There was a gap in Mississippi law at that point in time. So for that reason, the Attorney General, through the United States Attorney, certified that the state of Mississippi did not have jurisdiction over the juvenile for those two offenses, the possession and transfer of machine gun devices for the sale of the four on February 7th and the sale of the eight on February 20th. No one can dispute that the state did not have jurisdiction over those alleged acts of juvenile delinquency. While it's true that ultimately, as the case progressed, the defendant's sentence or the juvenile sentence was enhanced because he did possess a separate firearm, that was separate and apart from the two discrete acts that precipitated the federal case here. He was only charged federally with possession of machine gun conversion devices. He wasn't charged with possession of a handgun because the state could have brought proceedings against him for that. So we'd submit that the certification was proper in this case, that the state of Mississippi did not have jurisdiction over the defendant with respect to his alleged acts of juvenile delinquency. Now, turning to the Second Amendment issue, the government recognizes that the recent Como decision cuts against Judge McNeil's finding in this case, and that is that the Glock switch or machine gun conversion devices were not arms under the Second Amendment. We still urge that, but we recognize that recently the Como decision with respect to silencers does weigh against that finding. However, that doesn't result in a reversal here because we have Wilson and Hollis. And Wilson and Hollis foreclosed the defendant's argument in this case. Essentially, a machine gun conversion device turns a Glock, in this case, into a machine gun. And that's the only reason that it could be an arm under the Second Amendment. And this court in Wilson and Hollis found that you don't even reach the step two part of the Bruin test because they're unusual and dangerous devices, machine guns are. So we'd submit that the Second Amendment challenge is foreclosed, that the certification was proper, and that this court should affirm Judge McNeil's proper decision and render an opinion to that effect in this case. And if the court doesn't have any questions, I would cede the rest of my time.
All right, thank you, Mr. Buckner. Ms. McIntyre for rebuttal.
I guess I'll really just respond to the point about Hollis and Wilson foreclosing the issue, as well as the question of whether dangerous and unusual was encompassed in step one or step two. I think it's true, certainly, that Hollis and Wilson would foreclose an argument as to, like I said, a machine or a firearm that is equipped with an auto sear. Those were the circumstances in Wilson, even though I think the Wilson opinion also recognizes that they're really considering a facial challenge because of the way that the appellant had pled both on appeal and at the district court stage. And so at least as far as our facts go here, I don't think that Wilson precludes any kind of finding by this court that the juvenile Second Amendment rights were violated as applied to the way that the 922-0 statute was applied here to the mere possession of the switches. And so to talk about the step one or step two in terms of dangerous and unusual, I do think it is incorrect that Wilson endorsed a finding that dangerous and unusual is somehow encompassed in step one. I don't think Wilson necessarily takes a position one way or another, other than to say that Hollis remains binding. Obviously, Hollis was not applying the same step one, step two framework that we have post-Bruin, but the Wilson panel said that the ultimate result was not at odds with the way that we consider things post-Bruin. However, there's a quote in Wilson that I would direct this court to, and it's, "Far from abrogating Hollis, Bruin confirmed its major premise, that prohibitions on dangerous and unusual weapons are consistent with our historical tradition of firearm regulation." That's Wilson at site 386. That clearly makes a connection between a historical tradition of firearm regulation and this dangerous and unusual finding. So I don't think that there's a clear argument that that somehow is encompassed in step one. I think it has to be in step two. And there's a number of reasons why that would also make sense to put in step two. The first one being that Bruin says step one is plain text. And so the Second Amendment does not include any kind of language that would talk about dangerous and unusual. We get all of that, of course, from dicta, but then also in terms of a historical regulation. And so that necessarily comes into step two. And I think the other thing is that it makes sense that the government would carry the burden of proving that. Because, again, step one, once we show that the plain text implicates the regulation at issue, the burden thus shifts to the government to prove the historical regulation. That's true with almost every fundamental individual right. Once the plaintiff makes the prima facie showing, the burden then shifts to the government to justify the regulation. And in this case, that dangerous and unusual tradition would be something that the government would have to affirmatively prove in this case. That's really the only response I have to the government's argument. So unless this court has further questions, I would also cede the remainder of my time.
Yes, thank you, Ms. McIntyre.
Thank you.
Your case and all of today's cases are under submission, and the court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow.